Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. It was wheels up today for a group of veterans and their caregivers who are off on a special one-day VIP tour of Washington, D.C. This is the Mid-Michigan Honor Flight, which is, as we come to you here Wednesday morning, it's either about to take off or just took off. This is taking a group of 63 veterans on a special tour of Washington, D.C. The group stayed here at the MSU campus overnight, where they registered and got to know each other here, embarking on Mission 5 of the Mid-Michigan Honor Flight. The trip includes veterans of World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam, and it's a one-day whirlwind thing. The flight arrives back home, I think, around 9 p.m. this evening at Capital Region International Airport. At the top of our program today, supporters of an effort to legalize recreational marijuana in Michigan are facing a legal roadblock. Yesterday, state election officials ruled that the group MI Legalize fell short of the required number of petition signatures to put the issue on the November ballot. The group says it collected far more signatures than was required, but the Michigan Bureau of Elections says some of those signatures are invalid because they were collected outside of a 180-day collection window. Joining me now in the studio to talk about these developments and how they affect his campaign is the executive director of MI Legalize, East Lansing attorney Jeff Hank. Jeff, welcome back.
Good morning, Mark.
Let's clarify one point at the outset here. You're not disputing that a bunch of the signatures on your petition were more than 180 days old, correct? You admit it took, you collected some of these signatures 11 months ago.
We've been collecting for 11 months. That's
okay.
Right, since
okay.
Last June.
Your issue, I take it, is with the 180-day policy. Signatures on citizen petitions need to have been collected within 180 days of submitting the petition to the state, correct?
Well, they don't need to have been collected within 180 days. There's a different process for signatures that were collected more than 180 days old. Well, at least that was true until yesterday, until Governor Snyder signed SB 776.
Indeed. It went from being a policy up until yesterday to being law. Well, explain for us here, summarize what's wrong with the 180-day policy. Let's start there.
Well, if you limit petitioning in Michigan to 180 days with the number of requirements we need to get on the ballot, it makes it impossible for anybody but moneyed interests to succeed. There have never been a grassroots group that wasn't well-funded that makes the ballot.
So what makes the difference?
Money. It's money in organization.
Money to pay for what?
To pay for signatures. So if you want to make the ballot in 180 days, and this is what everybody does, you have to hire professional signature gathering firms. So the way this was originally envisioned, and if you go back and read the Constitutional Convention notes from 1963, the idea of the initiative process was to check the legislature. It was meant to be a check and balance, a fundamental part of our government for the citizens to check the legislature, rarely used when the legislature wouldn't do something that the people wanted to do. So if you limit it to 180 days, you effectively take away that ability for your average citizens group to do that, and you make it a tool more of moneyed special interests, because that's the only kind of group or person that is going to be able to succeed in 180 days if it's strictly limited to that. So that's the problem.
They've got the resources. A grassroots organization like yours is apt not to have the resources.
That's exactly it. And it wasn't designed to be a tool to be used by people to basically buy ballot access. It's meant to be a citizen's tool for when the legislature's not listening.
There have been legislative hearings on extending the 180-day limit. At one of those hearings, John Pirich, a constitutional law expert, testified twice against extending the limit. Quote, this process was never meant to be easy. It's supposed to be a high bar. How is he wrong?
Well, no, I absolutely agree with him. It isn't easy. It is a very high bar right now, and that's what I think a lot of people don't understand. They just assume, 180 days, you should be able to get the signatures. But it doesn't work that way. You can look at how rare these things actually make it to the ballot and then how rare it is for them to actually qualify. There's an initiative that makes it to the ballot and actually succeeds at the ballot about once every 10 years. So, for example, our group, we started 15-member board. We came up with the idea we wanted to create good policy. We had no money to start with. Now, over 11-month period, we were able to raise over $1 million. But starting off with no money, we petitioned for a month last June with really no money, just all volunteers. So A lot of people who say that have never run an initiative, and they don't realize how hard it actually is to get the number of signatures. So, for example, I'm an attorney, as you mentioned. If I work a regular job and I want to go out and petition in the evening on the streets of East Lansing, I may get 20 or 30 signatures a night. Now, when you think that you actually need to get 350 or 375,000 to qualify, it all of a sudden becomes a very major effort to coordinate. And that's not done by people who are just haphazardly or lapsedaisically going out and getting 10 or 20 signatures at a time. So it takes money and resources and organization to do it if you're going to do it in a short time period.
Back to the 180-day limit. What should the time limit be?
Well, the time limit has always historically been at least between the gubernatorial elections. So just so people understand this, we've had the initiatory right in Michigan since 1908. In 1963, we enacted a new constitution in Michigan. You had up to 4 years minus 120 days to circulate petitions for a statutory initiative or a constitutional amendment. The two things are different. Constitutional amendments require slightly more signatures. So from 1963 to 1972, there was none of this rebuttable presumption. And what the rebuttable presumption, which was enacted in 1972, was meant to do was it creates a different standard for signatures that are more than 180 days old. And this is the reason the Bureau of Elections is denying us. From 1972 to 1986, the state of Michigan didn't even force the rebuttal presumption law because Attorney General Frank Kelly said it was unconstitutional. In 1986, they created a policy, the Board of Canvassers anyway, that said if you want a petition beyond 180 days, you have to do one of two things. You either have to get everyone who's already signed your petition to sign an affidavit, or you have to get local clerks, which there's at least 1,500 of them in Michigan, to certify everyone that signed the petition to show that they were registered to vote at the time they signed the petition, and also within 180 days of submission to the state. So the first option is practically impossible. We can't track down hundreds of thousands of people. Pretty much everyone has acknowledged that. The second, getting the local clerks to do it, is also very difficult. It's very laborious. And in fact, we attempted to do that, and we were told by several clerks that they wouldn't do it. We can't force a clerk to do this, and it's never been done. In the last 30 years, no one's ever tried to do this. So we suggested to the Bureau of Elections that this policy was unconstitutional because it was so unduly burdensome that it was impossible to comply with. No one has ever even tried to do it, and that there's another option available, and that is to use the state's qualified voter file. And the qualified voter file is a database maintained by the state, which if you are in the qualified voter file, you are registered to vote. And the state actually uses the qualified voter file to canvass petitions for the signatures that are less than 180 days old. So we made the argument, you know, use the qualified voter file to canvass the entire petition, which we used a public copy of the qualified voter file to sort of pre-canvass our own petition before turning in so we knew we had enough sufficient signatures.
And you'd use the qualified voter file to certify that the signatures you received more than 180 days ago are valid?
That's right.
Is that where you're going?
That's where we're going. And so what we did is we did that ahead of time, even though it was extraordinarily expensive and a lot of work to do. But the way it works is, you know, it's hard to do because even on the last day of turning in our petition, we were still getting petitions in from people who had been petitioning for more than 180 days. So if we got a petition on the last day turned into us, we didn't have time to go check that database. So this idea of rebuttal presumption should be an after-the-fact thing. If the state canvasses the petition and says, hey, this person signed, you know, 7 months ago, we should then have the opportunity to show, listen, they were still registered to vote, their signature still counts. For example, I signed last June. In fact, every member of our board of directors signed last June. So my signature isn't being counted. And this is a quirky thing that your listeners will probably understand. It's actually a crime in Michigan to sign a petition twice. So if I went and signed again and said it's a fresh signature, less than 180 days, I'd be committing a crime under Michigan law.
So the one's invalid, but if you do it a second time, it's a crime.
Yeah. I mean, it's absurd. And so this is why we asked to just clean up this policy, and the Board of Canvassers wouldn't do it. And now they're using this policy to deny a huge chunk of our signatures and claim that we have insufficient signatures, even though if they canvass them all, we have enough signatures.
Let's fast forward to your ideal outcome of this whole dispute. I mean, you've said the bar should be high. Would using the QVF the way that you've described it here, would that set the bar high enough here on citizen petitions?
Yeah, it really doesn't make any difference because you still have to go out and do all the work to get the signatures, which is an extraordinary amount of work.
Yeah. But did you allude earlier? Are you saying that earlier people who wanted to launch a citizen's petition had 4 years to collect the signatures? I'm trying to read between the lines of your previous comment.
Is no time limit. Until yesterday, there was no time limit in Michigan law. But various attorney general opinions, and even John Peerich himself in 1986 when they litigated these cases, and all the top election attorneys at that time agreed that you had at least the time period between gubernatorial elections. Article 2, Section 9 of the Michigan Constitution states that you have the period between those elections minus 160 days for initiatives minus 120 days for constitutional amendments. So that actually means you have 3 years, 7 months to circulate petitions for initiatory petitions. You have at least that long.
We're talking about yesterday's decision by the Michigan Bureau of Elections to deny the validity of a petition to legalize recreational marijuana on the November ballot. MI Legalize is seeking to put the issue on the ballot. The state claims the group gathered signatures outside the 180-day window, and we're talking about the future of that process here with attorney Jeff Hank, who is executive director of MI Legalize. Do you have an issue with the 252,000 signatures? Is that too high?
Well, you know, a lot of people think that it might be. I do agree. It should be. This is a rare process. It shouldn't be something that things are just constantly thrown on the ballot. It's a rare process used to check the legislature when they won't do what the people want. And this particular issue, cannabis law reform, is something that the majority of Michigan citizens support, but that the legislature won't act upon. So I don't think it's too high, but trying to get those signatures in 180 days is. And if you go back again and read the Constitutional Convention notes from 1963, they had a huge debate about this. And at that time, they were concerned that they mentioned specifically the Farm Bureau, school groups, and labor groups would dominate the process and your average citizen wouldn't be able to. Now, it's some of those same groups that today are the ones that typically succeed in this, but it's also, you know, billionaires like Dick DeVos that typically finance these things. So if it's going to be the 8% of voters, which is what you do for a constitutional amendment, or 5% for statutory initiatives that you have to get.
That's 5%. That's where the 252,000 comes
that's
from.
That's right. Okay. And, you know, in order to do that in 180 days, this is just extraordinarily difficult.
Yesterday, the same day that it was recommended that your petition not be approved, Governor Snyder signed the 180-day window into law. It was a policy. Now it's a law. What do you take from that development?
Very disappointing. You know, there were several Republicans that defected from this vote in the state legislature. And, you know, the state legislature put this into immediate effect despite not having the votes to place this law into immediate effect. You know, this was not enacted by the House of Representatives with immediate effect, yet that's what's being done. So Governor Snyder had an opportunity to veto this. This is part of a trend. You know, we've seen in the past few years the time period shortened to recall elected officials. We see how the legislature tacks on appropriations so things can't be subject to a referendum. We saw the gag order on municipalities that was recently declared unconstitutional, the elimination of straight ticket voting. Well, this was the last sort of people's check, the power that hadn't been touched by the legislature. And as a result of us trying to clean up the process, and this is an interesting note, Mark, what we suggested by using the QVF, the state doesn't check every signature. So they sample 500 or 1,000 signatures out of our entire batch. That's how they do it. When we suggested use the QVF, that would mean that the state should check every single signature, which would eliminate election fraud. And they refused to do that.
So it'd be a more thorough process.
So we actually tried to improve Michigan election law, and the result was that was totally ignored. And instead, the citizens' ability to engage in this process has been foreclosed. We still have the right on paper, but you know it's going to be an illusory thing if you can't actually exercise that right.
Some number of our listeners are going to probably conclude this is a real partisan thing. Some of your comments so far this morning have suggested this may be less a partisan issue than we might think.
It's not partisan at all. It broke down somewhat along party lines, but you know, this affects everyone. So if people are upset about redistricting or Flint or some other issue that they'd want to push in Michigan, it affects all citizens' rights to have ballot access. So right now it might be Republican-Democrat issue, but 5 years from now it won't be. And in the past it hasn't been. You could have conservative groups pushing initiatives, liberal groups, whatever. So it affects everybody. It's really not a partisan issue. It's about our rights as Michigan voters to have our voice heard in government. And that's being foreclosed, and I think that's a bad thing.
You've threatened legal action if this happened. It's happened. What are your plans?
Well, the Board of Canvassers will act tomorrow. We're still waiting to hear.
Yesterday was a recommendation. We'll make that clear.
Staff report.
The formal decision comes tomorrow.
Yes, it does. And it's still unclear whether the Bureau of Elections is going to now retroactively apply a hard 180-day limit. So we turned our submissions in under an old statutory regime. We shouldn't be subject to a strict 180 days. However, they may or may not try to apply that going forward here. So after we see what happens tomorrow, I expect we'll be filing a lawsuit fairly shortly to get some of these issues resolved.
What's the future of marijuana legalization in Michigan? Now, don't tell us what you want. Tell us what you think objectively. What is the future of this?
I think it's coming. I mean, people realize that the public opinion polls are there. You know, every few months out of Colorado, the news gets better and better. The public supports it there more. People who are opposed to it are starting to support it. People are getting refund checks back. They're putting the money into schools. We're going to see 6 to 8 states here in November, which Michigan could be one, probably do this. So the trend is headed that way. That's what public opinion is. And we tried to get ahead of the curve here and take advantage of this so Michigan could realize some of the economic benefits. And I think you're going to find that in an era where revenue is harder and harder to find, this is sort of the last of the easy money out there to get to fund things like roads and schools, and that at some point politicians will do it if we don't succeed this year.
We are talking about the decision by the Michigan Bureau of Elections. This is yesterday to deny the validity of a petition to legalize recreational marijuana. I've been talking about the status of this with one of the proponents of marijuana legalization. Jeff Hank is an attorney and the executive director of MI Legalize. We'll keep an eye on it. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
And coming up on Current State, Helping Hands Respite Care's mission is to improve the quality of life for families caring for children and adults with disabilities, chronic illness, or age-related conditions. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with Helping Hands Executive Director John Stauffer and volunteer Katie Donovan. That's on the way on Current State. According to the State Department of Transportation, there are 36,000 miles of streams in Michigan. On any given day, you're apt to find Doc Fletcher exploring one of them. The Northville resident is a lifelong kayaker and canoeist and is the author of 8 books. On his last visit here to Current State, we discussed his 2015 book, Paddling and Pastimes, 6 Midwest Cities, the Rivers That Made Them, the Baseball Teams That Entertained Them. Fletcher says he'd been looking for an excuse to work his enthusiasm for America's pastime into one of his books.
The more I thought about it, you get out on a river and there's a peacefulness, and you're not on the clock, and it's a dreamy place to be. And I'm thinking, well, it's just like a ballpark. And if I could have put myself back 100 years on either a river or a ballpark, there's a timeless happiness that both have. You could be at a ball game and 1915, and you'd hear the same noise in the field and the crowd in the stands and the vendors shouting. And a river's a lot like that, too. I always felt like a river. When I get on the water, it's a chance to reach out and touch history. There's a minimal riverside development as you're going down most of Michigan's rivers. You feel like you're experiencing something that the original residents of the state experienced when they went down the river. And so I saw a lot of parallels, neither on the clock, the peacefulness of both, and more than anything, an excuse to get into ballparks around the Midwest, I suppose. So,
well, these were pretty big cities you visited this time around and experienced up real up close. Pittsburgh, Cleveland, yep. Detroit, Chicago, yeah. Milwaukee, and Minneapolis.
Yeah, we're not talking about Holland, Michigan, and the small towns anymore. Most people think you're going down a river. You have this view of you going down a narrow and shallow riverbed, maybe 15 feet wide, through a forest of oak and maple.
Indeed.
And birch. But I was inspired by a trip I took in 2009 down the last 5 miles of the Rouge River into the Detroit River, a trip I never thought I would take. And within a half an hour going down the Rouge, I'm going by Henry Ford's Rouge Assembly Plant. And it just seemed so amazing to me. I started thinking about perhaps writing a book that was nothing but large, big urban rivers. But that would force me to get out of Michigan, which has been my comfort zone mm-hmm. on every one of the books except one on Wisconsin. So I looked around the Midwest, and I thought, wouldn't it be neat to tie in a trip down these big rivers that major Midwest cities evolved from, that also had a baseball park right along the water. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you look at the book cover of Paddling and Pastimes, you'll see it was taken from me kayaking down the Allegheny River underneath the beautiful golden Sixth Street Bridge, also known as the Roberto Clemente Bridge, right alongside PNC Park, home
sure.
of Pirates.
A legendary pirate.
Yes.
I remember kayaking up the Chicago River about 10 years ago, and I loved it. Don't get me wrong, but urban paddling can be a profoundly different experience. What would you consider the rewards of kayaking a river in a big city?
I think if you have a fascination for history and architecture, you will love going down these big rivers. As an example, the Chicago River you're just speaking about, right near what they call Wolf's Point, where all three branches come together, the mid-stem that takes you out to Lake Michigan, then the north and the south.
Right.
Just south of there, you have the tallest occupied building in North America, the Willis Tower, the old Sears Tower. And you're paddling past a structure that's 1,450 feet high. And if your eyes are really good, you can see the glass plank that sticks out from
the
floors at 1,353 feet, which just thinking about it gives me a little bit of vertigo. And as you go further down the South Branch, you're passing along where Mrs. O'Leary's cow acted up in 1871. Oh, we also on the South Branch went past where a building called the Wigwam was, and that's where the Young Republican National Party nominated Abe Lincoln for president. So there's so much of the history as you're going down these rivers.
Now, when you were in Chicago, though, which ballpark did you profile?
Did you go
to both?
We had,
okay.
Yeah, we had, yeah. That was an easy decision.
North side.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And as we took tours on every one of these ballparks, so we could gain more information on the parks and share them with the readers. And we had tour guides. I found that every Major League Baseball park in the country has both private and public tours of their stadium. And you want to go ideally when the team's not there, because you can get on the field, you can get in the press box. Oh, and the views from the press box are just unbelievable. But you hear stories. And one of the stories we heard was when the Chicago Cubs last won a World Series in 1908, the heavens parted, and the Lord said to the Cubs, "Don't do anything until I get back."
That's beautiful.
That's just beautiful.
What about the Detroit River here? Let's return to Michigan. Why should a Michigan kayaker consider the Detroit River as a destination?
Well, something that I didn't even know existed was found off the Detroit River. We launched at a place called Maharis Gentry Park on the east side, and we went against the current up towards Lake St. Clair. They have historic east side canals that run off of the river. And one of these canals is called Little Venice, where instead of homes that are across the street from each other being divided by 30 feet of concrete, they're divided by 30 feet of a river. And you actually feel like you are in Venice. Mm. And some of the homes we passed by in Little Venice were purchased by the organized crime group, the Purple Gang, during Prohibition. And you can pass by these homes where they built lookout towers on top of the homes to give them a better view of the police boats that were coming. And they were coming.
How interesting.
Yeah, 80% of all the illegal alcohol came in the United States during Prohibition across the Detroit River or adjacent Lake St. Clair River. Just absolutely fascinating.
I'll tell you, you've got a history professor inside of you just waiting to break out.
Absolutely.
Now, I understand Pittsburgh was in a special, you've already mentioned it once, but the Allegheny and Pittsburgh, the city and the river, I take it as well, has experienced a really dramatic turnaround over the years.
Turnaround in many ways, but the health of the river and the health of the city has just, in fact, all six of these rivers were very sick bodies of water up until the 1970s, 1980s. Pittsburgh, as an example, as recently as the 1950s, all three of their rivers, there was only one species of fish that was strong enough to survive, the bluegill. One. Today, 53 species of fish survive.
Wow.
There's been cooperative efforts on all six of these rivers of volunteers, government agencies, and businesses to work together to help make better decisions on how they interact with the rivers they're on. The Chicago River. As recently as the 1980s, if you were paddling down the Chicago River and fell into the water, you were immediately taken to emergency.
Oh, my gosh.
And today, you can see the increase in the number of species of fish, species of birds and insects are just proliferating on Chicago River, the Cuyahoga River, the Detroit River, Milwaukee River. It's fabulous. It's just very, very exciting what's happening in these waterways.
Michigan kayaker author Doc Fletcher is our guest. He's written many books about his kayaking experiences, mainly in Michigan, but his latest is called Paddling and Pastimes, Six Midwest Cities, The Rivers That Made Them, The Baseball Teams That Entertained Them. Now, with the turnaround in the status of these rivers, is activity up? How much activity did you encounter on these various rivers?
It varied, but boy, the Chicago River, we saw groups of 15 to 20 kayakers out on the waterway. Mm. The Detroit River, there is a business called Riverside Kayak Connection out of Wyandotte downriver, and they have six trips each year that take you to those east side canals, but they also have trips that take you around circumnavigation around Belle Isle. And there's groups, there's liveries that are out there that are taking advantage of the increased interest in people paddling these rivers. And they organize events, and as a result, you see a lot of these organized events, large groups of people, but you also see individual paddlers out there out on the water as people are understanding that the rivers are becoming cleaner and that there's great recreational opportunities that are now in front of them that didn't exist before. The Chicago River and Milwaukee River take you right out to Lake Michigan, and that's pretty fascinating paddle in and of itself.
Have you had enough of urban kayaking, though, now that the book is behind you and you're gonna kind of stay in more remote locations?
Well, yeah, a bit, including locally here. 2 months ago, I paddled the Red Cedar with my friends Nate and Paul at Rivertown Adventures. I believe we spoke last year.
They've been on our program.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, great guys. They do 4 cleanups of the Red Cedar every year. They get volunteers from MSU, they do a wonderful job. But we paddle what they call the Spartan Nation that took us by the Kresge Arts Center, the Rock, the beautiful gift from the class of 1873. And also, as we were paddling through campus, we got such a kick out of seeing students on hammocks swinging back and forth right over the edge of the water. And we went through the rapids at the administration building. Just absolutely a fabulous trip. And anytime you can go by Spartan Stadium and Sparty itself is a great adventure.
Michigan paddler and author Doc Fletcher there. The book is called Paddling and Pastimes, Six Midwest Cities, The Rivers That Made Them, The Baseball Teams That Entertained Them. Now this August, Doc Fletcher returns to Current State and to the Library of Michigan to discuss his latest adventures as well as his newest book, Canoeing and Kayaking College Campuses in Michigan. Coming up on Current State, MSU flute professor and Lansing Symphony principal Richard Sherman talks with us about his recent CD for Lansing's Blue Griffin Recordings. WKAR's Peter Worf speaks with Richard about his golden instrument's French Connection. That and more after the break on Current State. Programming on 90.5 WKAR is different, and it's better because of help from caring listeners like you. Please continue extraordinary programs like Current State for you and your community by becoming a sustaining donor. Use the Give Now button on WKAR.org, and with your new or increased monthly donation of $10 or more per month, you'll receive a WKAR reusable travel mug as part of our thanks to you. Donate today online, WKAR.org. We thank you. When our loved ones have disabilities or struggle with age-related limitations, we want to do everything we can to take care of them, but we often forget a very important piece of that care, taking care of ourselves. Many don't know that there are organizations committed to helping caretakers with planned respite time. It's a time when they can take a break and get help caring for the loved ones. It can help reduce family stress and minimize the need for out-of-home placements. East Lansing's Helping Hands Respite Care is just one such organization. And joining us now for Neighbors in Action this week, Executive Director John Stauffer. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Mark.
And Katie Donovan, a volunteering consultant for the organization. Katie, welcome.
Happy to be here.
John, you offer so many services. We're going to get into a few of the main ones, but can you give us some kind of overview here, the range of services that you provide?
Well, when you talk about a range, Mark, what I like to say is we take care of things from autism to Alzheimer's. Our youngest client is 3, our oldest is 95. Mm. And because we do focus as our core mission being respite, giving that primary care provider some time away from their loved one, we really do run the whole spectrum. Alzheimer's, traumatic brain injury, Parkinson's, dementia, autism, cerebral palsy. I mean, we take care of all of that.
But the heart of your service, though, is to give the caretakers assistance.
Absolutely. Here. Time away so that they can take care of themselves. We're there with highly trained individuals that are able to give a comfort level and a trust level to that family member who normally takes care of that loved one so they can step away for a while.
And you have several different facilities, correct?
Correct.
Katie, the Weekend Respite House is one of the most popular programs, I take it. What is it exactly?
It is. I've only visited it a couple of times, but it's an amazing opportunity for families, especially with children or older children who really need more than just a few hours of a break. So this provides 48 hours of respite for the family, and exciting activities and wonderful camaraderie for the ones that participate in that program.
I imagine people come out of there feeling like totally different people maybe than when they walked in.
It's they absolutely do.
Transformational. John, let's talk about your adult day services too, because that's one of your other big programs. What do the adult day services entail exactly?
Well, we're very proud of our Adult Day Services program. It's actually been in the community for 32 years now, so kind of a best-kept secret. And while there are growing adult day centers in our Tri-County community, ours is still the largest and the oldest, and we serve the oldest population. So we have a fairly frail population. Our average age at our Adult Day Services is 82 years old, but our mission says we'll serve from 18 and up. We just have a lot of those that are older that come to our service. I think because of what we offer a nurse on staff all day long. And that's not a requirement for an adult day service. We've just always done that.
But so, John, these are for the caregivers, correct?
Yes, but understand when you drop your loved one off at our adult day services with dementia, that caregiver now can go to work and spend 8 hours at work. That caregiver can now go to the grocery store. That caregiver can go and play cards with their friends while we're taking care of their loved one.
Okay, okay. I'm speaking with John Stauffer, Executive Director of Helping Hands Respite Care, also Katie Donovan, who is a consultant and volunteer with the organization. Katie, you lead an initiative called Kate's Memory Cafe, which sounds intriguing. What does it do?
It is. It was a very exciting concept that we stumbled upon, and we decided to take it on. And since I decided to step up and volunteer my hours to make this happen, it's a second Sunday of the month social event, and it's for the caregiver and their care partners who may have an early or mid-stage diagnosis of Alzheimer's or dementia. And so it's a social event. Mm. And there's a meal, there's live music, there's fun, and then there's a little bit of education for that caregiver in the mix to help them understand how important it is for them to claim some time for respite.
Mm-hmm. And it's free.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We forget about that part.
You've anticipated my next question. Do your services cost anything, John?
Many of our services do, but we have a variety of pipelines to help the families with those services. At our Adult Day Services Center, about 25% of our people are private pay, but we have contracts with the Veterans Administration, we have contracts with Community Mental Health, we have contracts with Tri-County Office on Aging. All of these agencies help our families pay for the services that we provide.
And the funding that you do receive, where does that come from?
Most of our funding is Medicare-related or Medicaid-related. It comes down waiver programs from the federal government to the state through those agencies I just mentioned, like Community Mental Health or Tri-County Office on Aging. And through those people, a case manager is often assigned to the families. They're authorized hours, and then they contract with us to have those hours fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. Katie, to what extent does Helping Hands rely on volunteers?
Well, we really want to rely more on volunteers. We've just, as we've grown in the past few years, we've really recognized the importance of having an official and important volunteer program that really creates an opportunity that enhances a volunteer's life, as well as enhances the operations of our programs and the people that they're serving.
What kinds of things would a volunteer typically do at Helping Hands, John?
Mark, the range is great. They can show up one time, like on July 31st, we're going to have a special program where folks from Pi Kappa Phi, the fraternity men, are riding from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. They'll be stopping by our center at the Valley Court Community Center in East Lansing, and I could use a ton of volunteers to help welcome them and help with the party in the park that we're going to have that day, because they're riding to raise money for needs like agencies such as ours. So that's a one-time volunteer. But we also have programs where we're trying to have volunteers match up with families and with team leaders in homes and actually provide on-site care in the home with the family. Talk about the opportunity to make a difference in someone's life.
Katie, talk to us about the volunteer aspect. I know you serve as
sure.
a consultant as well, but talk about the volunteer experience for you.
Well, you know, for me, the Memory Cafe happens just once a month, and it's probably the highlight of my month because I feel so invested in it as mm-hmm. a volunteer. We created it to kind of honor, at least I decided to do it, to honor my father who passed from Alzheimer's and my mother who was his, you know, constant caregiver.
Yeah.
And I really saw her being so vulnerable. So when I see these families really get what we're saying and embrace this and enjoy the time that they have, I feel so empowered that I'm helping them understand how to claim that respite time for themselves.
Is there a person or two that you've worked with that
sure.
Stands out in your memory?
You know, there's one couple that comes, and when they first started coming, I could tell that the wife in the mix, who was the caregiver, was really, really crackly. She was just so exhausted. And for her, she used to step away just a few feet and sit in a comfy chair and close her eyes for just a few minutes and listen to the music. And to me, that was just that little bit of claiming of respite care.
Yeah.
Last month, she came in, kicked off her shoes, laid down on the couch, and let her husband enjoy the activities.
Yeah. How about that? You know, it can be stressful, a lot of stress associated with that, a lot of skills are necessary to take care of people facing these challenges. What kind of training does your staff go through, John?
Mark, we're so proud of our training program. We have evolved our training in the 5 years that I have been the executive director, and our current training method for our new care providers is starts with 78 online classes. I know that sounds really intimidating.
It does.
But they're very short classes. It's to make sure they understand the point. It's a very short test for each class, 5-6 questions, but they have to have 100% on every question. If they don't get it right, they have to go back and redo it.
But that's this is staff we're talking about,
this
or volunteers?
No, this is staff.
This is staff.
This is
okay.
staff.
Okay.
But volunteers get the opportunity, depending on how they want to volunteer, to possibly follow that same track. We also have 1 day of training in-house so they understand the philosophy of who we are as an agency and what we have to do. And then we also have 2 days of OJT, on-the-job training, either in the home or with our adult day services program or our Guyer Community Young Teen and Adult program that we have. So there's a lot of effort that goes into making sure either the volunteer or the care provider is very comfortable with working with that individual before we cut them loose.
There is a tendency, I think, for caregivers not to make noise, not to reach out, not to seek help. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that there's a moment of pride and a sense of responsibility. And for us, we know that the stakes are really high because very often in that relationship, the most vulnerable one is the caregiver because mm-hmm. they're expending all of their energy and mm-hmm. all of their thoughts and energy are focused on that loved one. And they don't realize that they're the most vulnerable and they need that help. And often they come to us a little too late.
We know you have an event called Walk Beyond the Barriers coming
yes.
up. Tell us about that, Katie.
Well, that's a regular event that we do twice a month, and it's our opportunity to really tell the stories that demonstrate the value of what it is that we do for the community. And it's a great way to kind of engage with individuals on a very personal level so that they really understand and can connect and recognize that the value that they have as an individual with their heart and their interest in our programs, we give them opportunities. It's our opportunity to find out if they want to volunteer. It's our opportunity to cultivate them as long-term supporters of our organization. And it's just such an important way to create that engagement and to begin. And it's just 1 hour.
When is the event?
We do it the second and the fourth Tuesdays of the month.
Okay.
And the second Tuesday, it's at 8:30 in the morning. And on the fourth, it's at 11:30 in the afternoon.
I have been speaking with Executive Director of Helping Hands Respite Care, John Stauffer, and Katie Donovan, consultant and volunteer with Helping Hands. John, Katie, thank you for being here. Continued success. We hope you generate some volunteers.
Thank you so much.
All right. Current states looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. When MSU's Richard Sherman speaks of the French Connection, think great music instead of classic film. The music of French masters is at the heart of the respected flute professor's new recording entitled Bucolique. It's the third such disc in a series of works for flute and piano. Sherman's instruments has deep roots in French and even ancient culture. In this conversation with WKAR's Peter Wharf, Richard explains how French composers transformed the flute from a pastoral melodic instrument into a virtuosic one.
The flute could all of a sudden travel like a violinist could do.
Right.
And so all these showpieces were written that became a little bit insipid over time, lots of themes and variations and things like that. And so that became the emphasis of the French school. And so a lot of it was, what can you do with vibrato? What can you do with tone color? What can you do with nuance? And so the first French album I did were the pretty more recognizable pieces. And then I just kept applying for grants, and Michigan State University is very, very keen and supportive of projects of this nature. The second one was an homage to French composers who also wrote flute etudes, so studies that I make my students do. Right. And the third one I never expected to get funded for, works that are either out of print or they're not readily available. And they have certainly not been recorded readily or regularly.
But to classical music lovers, I think in some ways this is the most interesting of the three recordings. You have some uber romantic sounds from some of these composers, and then other styles that are sort of on the edge of the 19th and 20th centuries.
I would agree. The Malmbrun piece particularly has a harmonic language that is very hard to classify. I tend to, you know, be a romantic at heart, but I like to keep myself interested, both harmonically and expressively. So I'm always looking for pieces that might be of interest to, first and foremost, to myself, and then I want to share them with other people and get them, enthusiastic about them.
This is Peter Wharf for Current State. I'm speaking with MSU flute professor Richard Sherman. He's also, of course, the principal flutist of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. Speaking of composers that might not be household names, you open with the music of Gabriel Grosvenor, and to me it was such a joyous opening to the disc.
Yeah, I have this great love of Puccini opera, And I like the immediacy and the heartfeltness, if that's a word, of the best arias from Puccini opera. And even though this is a French piece, I think that the romance, the first movement, is incredibly operatic and sounds Italian to me. So it appealed to me in my operatic sensibilities.
We talk a little bit about maybe the most well-known composer besides Debussy in your new recording, Louis Durey.
Durey, yeah.
Known as maybe the least famous of Les Six, right?
Yeah, but it sort of follows. It's funny that you should say that because I remember my former teacher at the Eastman School did a recital of Les Six flute and piano music when I was still a student. And of all the works, including Poulenc Sonata, I liked this one the most. And I thought, I don't understand why this piece isn't played more. I think there's an innocence to it. The first movement particularly is very childlike and very, very optimistic. The second movement is very, very plaintive, and the last movement just sounds like, you know, sleigh ride almost to me. It has a very festive kind of snowy day kind of feel to it.
Yeah, I agree. And in some ways, this work in the new collection touches on the widest range of emotions.
I find that I was never really drawn to the bravura show pieces. I thought they were always kind of shallow. Mm. And I thought that, yeah, any monkey can get around an instrument. But what you say in terms of phrasing and color is what is, to me, where it's at.
Richard Sherman is professor of flute at Michigan State University, principal flutist of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. What's it like for you to navigate that world of solo and chamber music and orchestral player? Not a lot of people do that.
Nor did I ever think I would, frankly.
You've said that.
I've always seen myself as an orchestral flutist first.
Yeah.
And that's what I thought best suited my skill set.
Why did you think you would originally go in that direction? It's just the love of the repertoire, that type of playing. What was it?
Well, my dad told me that I was at the Eastman School, that I was going to be independent when I was 21. And I had started as a music education major. And since I decided to change my major from music ed to performance, the quickest way to get employed, from the way I saw it, was to get into an orchestra. And I was just naive enough or optimistic enough to think, well, someone's got to get the job. Why shouldn't it be me?
And good enough.
And you know, so I always, you know, the buck stops with me. I've always felt that way. I can't blame anybody else for my lack of application or whatever. So part of it was a practical dimension that I wanted to get employed. But I also thought, and I still feel, that the greatest works for us are in the orchestra. Now, some people might argue that, but we don't have a Brahms sonata. We don't have much Debussy. But in the orchestra, we have Lemaire, and we have all sorts of...
Daphnis and Claude.
Well, that's actually his counterpart. You know, with Ravel, you know, those rivals, those friends, whatever they were at the time. Yeah, you can't beat it.
This week I was listening to Dvorak Eighth,
which is a flute concerto.
Richard, it's always a pleasure to listen to you and to have you today on WKAR.
That's my pleasure, Peter.
Richard Sherman is professor of flute at Michigan State University and principal flutist of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. Thanks again.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, a Detroit institution turns 150 years old this year. Scott Pohl talks with Keith Wunderlich, unofficial historian of the Verner's Ginger Ale Collectors Club. Verner's is 150. A celebration is coming up on Saturday, by the way. Plus, we'll continue our series of interviews with the candidates running for Ingham County Prosecutor. Carol Seaman joins us tomorrow on Current State. By the way, we visited with Helping Hands Respite Care of East Lansing here just a few minutes ago on Neighbors in Action. We want to mention their website in case you'd like more information. We typically do that. It is helpinghandsrespite.care. That's a new domain that you may not have heard of, but it is accurate. helpinghandsrespite.care. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Drew, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher for Android, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.